Hey, I'm Ashwin, and I'm at a Halloween block party on Mason Avenue, and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you, Ashwin. Love Ashwin. He's rocking that Halloween block party. Fantastic. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. This is show number 785. And what we do here on this program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Of course, say hello to us online on Twitter at Outside the Loop, Instagram, Facebook, or whatever it's called now. Is it Meta? Meta, right? Yeah, Meta. Do that and download the podcast of the show. It can get delivered to your device each week for free if you subscribe. So smash that subscribe button, as the kids say, and subscribe to the podcast of Outside the Loop. Check out OutsideTheLoopRadio.com and WGNRadio.com for the audio archives of the show. Happy Halloween weekend. I hope you are celebrating in a festive way, getting those costumes on, and enjoying yourselves this weekend. And scary news here, speaking of Halloween. The Hideout, and I've mentioned the Hideout multiple times on this program because we feature local music, and it's just one of the best places to see a show in all of Chicagoland. It's a small joint in Chicago, and historic, great room. The Hideout has been vandalized twice in the month of October. This is according to the Hideout's Instagram page. They say, quote, "We believe it is our duty to make the public aware for their safety and our staff when coming and leaving the Hideout. On October 4th, our electric cables were cut. Our ComEd electric meter was stolen. An unsigned note with anti-vaccination rhetoric was left taped to the empty meter box. On October 17th, white supremacist symbols and graffiti were spray painted on our glass block windows, front door, and our neighbor's building behind our patio. We have implemented additional security measures, both seen and unseen, including security and perimeter cameras. The Hideout has always and will continue to be committed to the safety for staff, performers, and patrons." End quote. What the heck is going on in our society when you're vandalizing a great place like the Hideout with this garbage? And it's important to get the word out that this is happening, right? That people harbor this belief or these beliefs, and so much so that they're willing to put that in graffiti form, vandalize places, of course, cowardly, because it's not like these folks are signing their names to any of this stuff. So when it comes to that, you know, white supremacist rhetoric, no time for that. No time for that at all. And the fact that it's manifesting itself at a place like the Hideout, which is all about inclusivity and diversity and art, is really disturbing. So this element is still out there in society, and we have to keep talking about it to address it so we can interrupt it and ultimately destroy it. As for the anti-vax stuff, I don't even know. I'm just shaking my head. I don't know. I don't have time for that either. I can't do it. I just can't do it. I said last week how there's a lot of just bad news out there these days, and this is unfortunately part of that, but we're better than all this. And certainly the Hideout, much love to the Hideout. Great people, Tim Tutton, Katie over there as well. They're great people who are committed to the arts in Chicago, so let's give some love to the Hideout. Let's give some love to today's show. A lot to do. Award-winning cultural critic and author Anne Elizabeth Moore joins us. She has a new book out called Gentrifier. Also, we'll talk about another new book that talks about the toxic culture of hockey. And we revisit a segment from Halloween weekend 4 years ago, the gravesite underneath the Reed Dunning Memorial Park on the northwest side of Chicago. Stay tuned. It's so scary. And Anne Elizabeth Moore is an award-winning cultural critic. She's an author, and her latest book is called Gentrifier, a memoir. And her website, AnneElizabethMoore.com, is wonderful because it gives all the information about this wonderful person who I don't think, Anne, when's the last time we talked on the radio?
You know, it was probably 5 years ago, right after I left Chicago.
Oh, my goodness. Well, hey, nice to talk to you again.
Exactly. I'm thrilled to be here.
Well, it's great. Great to have you back on. It's been some time. And yeah, I think it was when you were leaving Chicago back in around 2016. And so that actually ties into this book, this new book. Again, it's called Gentrifier, a memoir. The story that you tell here is based on your experiences moving to Detroit. So if you could just set the scene, what's going on here? What's the crux of this story?
Yeah, in 2016, I won a free house from an organization based in Detroit that was giving houses away to low-income writers. But the book unfolded because it turns out that the house wasn't all that free, and it belonged to someone else.
So, and I'm not laughing at you, but like I'm just laughing at the absurdity of the situation, right?
Yeah.
All right, yeah. So, I mean, it's crazy to think that like, okay, you got a house, and that's what happened. You got a free house in this neighborhood in Detroit, and as you say, that's where the story sort of begins. But there are more layers as you keep going into the story, and more sort of layers to this are peeled back. The neighborhood that you moved into Detroit, how does that area play a role in the book?
Well, it was wonderful. And I think, in fact, the last time we talked a lot about this neighborhood. The house I was given was in a part of town that has since been designated Banglatown, which is primarily Bangladeshi, but also Yemeni neighborhood in Detroit. And it's filled with very tiny bungalows that are, teeny little single family homes that were built for factory workers for the plants, the Ford and Dodge main plants down there. And so it's a very like tight knit immigrant majority community that I just came to love. And you know, I don't want to be too pretentious or anything, but I think they liked me too.
Of course. Well, you know, it's the story here. The book is called Gentrifier. And here you come into this neighborhood as a white person, right? And I think, you know, this story is somewhat familiar, especially to us here in Chicago, where we see neighborhoods that have gone through gentrification that, you know, these neighborhoods maybe had a sort of ethnic or cultural identity. And fast forward 10, 20 years, things look a little different. Is that kind of what you were getting at here?
Well, interestingly, my project with the organization that gave me the house was not to turn the neighborhood into a white-friendly enclave, although I think that was the concern that everyone had when they gave a white, you know, queer writer with disabilities a house in a majority immigrant community. But in fact, my project was to sort of help stabilize the neighborhood, to be a presence that would offer neighbors a consistent and sort of reliable person. I mean, people were moving out of that neighborhood every single week when I moved in. And within a year, the neighborhood had kind of turned around. It had stabilized. People decided to stick around and be in it for the long haul. And so that's a little bit the opposite of what we think of when we think about gentrification.
Mm-hmm.
But the more we move into the story, the more we discover that, you know, the sort of hidden history of my house does indicate a large scale project of gentrification in which I played a significant role. And so your relationship to that term does change over the course of the book. So at first, we think that it's about an individual moving into a neighborhood that is not necessarily, you know, historically a part of the spaces that they have been open to in the city. But as we travel through the narrative, I think we learn that actually gentrification is something that is often put in place by cities and kept in strong, kept in by strong policies that really do support white people to take over spaces from which black people and immigrants have been evicted or had their houses foreclosed on or have had their sort of general like generational wealth taken from them.
You know, it's interesting when you say that, because at first we might not see that, right? Like, we've heard of the term gentrification, but until maybe you have gone through it, in the sense like what happened to you, you moved into this minority majority neighborhood, and like you say, your relationship to that word changes, and maybe you start to see some of the systemic guardrails that are in place that maybe shape neighborhoods to be what they become. And then we ask ourselves, boy, how did this happen? I don't know where this came from, but in reality, it was all kind of part of the structural design, even if you can't see it at the outset.
Exactly. And I think that in my case, you know, the idea that I was given this free house as a writer who contributes, you know, important intellectual words to the community,
of course,
was supposed to be this, that's exactly what I do, was supposed to be this like prize. Like, I'd worked for a long time and not been paid very much for, you know, my entire career. And this was supposed to be the big like moment of celebration. And then directly under that moment of celebration is this history of violence against black folks in particular. And I think, you know, we have to start asking larger questions about what are we really celebrating here? And is that the kind of community we want to be?
Right. And who has access to these resources? Because, you know, getting a house is sort of looked at as the American dream. That's it. And it's been like that for generations. You get that house, you build equity, you get another one, maybe you sell it, you make some money. And that's part of the sort of American story. But not everyone has even the ability to get a house. And certainly if you look at our history with redlining and all of those policies, I mean, those were intentional moves to, you know, shape the urban landscape to what it is today. And I think it's interesting that you're tapping into this. And I guess my next question is, you know, when we think of housing and we say that there's a housing crisis in the United States, how does your book sort of play into that when we think of the United States and this idea of a housing crisis?
Well, my book specifically tells the sort of a little bit unique story of the Detroit foreclosure crisis, in which one out of every four homes in the city was foreclosed on between, I think, 2011 and 2017. That was in the past, and now that we have evictions are, you know, back on the table, and we have, you know, a rampant increase in sort of financiers that are looking to buy a property, and also property prices have just gone out of control. You know, it's probably not too far off of that now either. And so that is unique to Detroit, and that Detroit's property tax foreclosure system is not duplicated everywhere. But the idea that we are finding ourselves in the midst of a rapid demand for profit from a smaller and smaller number of people who also happen to be buying up all the available real estate and eradicating as many, especially black women with children, as they possibly can. This is what the housing crisis looks like. And this is only getting worse, you know, under the pandemic, and as the pandemic starts to ease a little bit with more and more vaccines available, I think that this is not easing. We are at the precipice of a very, very, very dire situation in which, what's the number? It's like 4.7 million people are at risk of foreclosure.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's nationwide, and that's completely unacceptable. And that's, you know, on top of the existing housing crisis as it stands at this moment, which is already unacceptable. So, you know, this is a very small story of navigating that terrain. And it's, you know, it's an odd book in that it's very funny for such a story. But in fact, it is, those are the building blocks that we exist in the midst of a horrifying housing crisis, and we need to start paying attention to it because it needs to stop.
Well, you're going to be in Chicago once again to talk about the book. Again, it's called Gentrifier, a Memoir. You will be at Exile in Bookville. I love that name, by the way, Exile in Bookville, of course, a nod to the great Liz Phair.
Of course.
Thursday, that's November the 4th, 7 p.m., and you're doing an online activity, an online, I don't know what to call it, meeting, interview, party with Quimby's, the folks from Quimby's, on Friday, November 5th at 7:30 p.m., right?
That is correct, and the Exile in Bookville event will be a little bit of conversation about the book, but mostly hanging around and hugging people. So get vaccinated, make sure you bring your vax card, but come in person. It's going to be a blast.
I love it. I love it. And we can check out AnnElizabethMoore.com for all of the information about you, Ann Elizabeth Moore. You are an author, award-winning cultural critic, and the book, the newest book, Gentrifier, a Memoir. Hey, it's been way too long. Let's not wait 5 years until we do this again.
It's a deal.
I love it. Ann, thank you so much.
Thank you. It was great.
Are a great entertainment and athletic outlet for all of us. And to an extent, sports can actually tell the story of who we are as a society. A new book co-authored by local journalist Evan F. Moore called Game Misconduct, Hockey's Toxic Culture and How to Fix It, dives into the world of hockey to explore some cultural challenges that sport is facing. Evan F. Moore is with us here on Outside the Loop today. Evan, nice to talk to you again.
Thanks. Appreciate you having me.
You are quite welcome. So, all right, you're talking about hockey here. You've co-authored this book on hockey's toxic culture. So the first question is, can you explain to us what is that culture, that hockey culture, like right now?
It's a lot going on, honestly. We like look at it. I mean, these issues are in all sports, but for some reason, hockey, it appears to be more insidious because it's out of the four major, you know, North American sports. You know, you got hockey, you got basketball, football, and baseball. Hockey is kind of has less scrutiny and less, you know, interest is in each sport. And also things happen. You're not really looking at hockey, but you, like, you're someone who's like a longtime fan, observer, journalist, you know, in recent years, a player, and even more recently, a parent, a hockey player. You kind of see these issues playing out.
And the issues that we're talking about here, I mean, it runs everything from racism to ableism, homophobia. There's a lot going on, as you say. But these are some issues. And again, you could hear us talking about this and say, like, well, you know, this probably is prevalent in other sports as well. So why is this different when we talk about hockey?
Well, hockey's my favorite sport. And me and Davina, that's our favorite sport. We decided to write a book about hockey. And put it in the simplest terms, I mean, yeah, we are. I mean, before some people even read the book, I mean, some folks in the hockey world are aware of our reputation and some of the things we've discussed over time about race and diversity issues and bullying and sexual assault and that nature. So people are kind of like, oh, you're trying to quote unquote cancel hockey. And that's not even the case at all. You know, we love the sport, you know, and we just feel like it could be better in a lot of ways. And, you know, we feel like that the sport can do better by people who aren't from traditionally, you know, hockey hotbeds. And, you know, and over the years, you've seen people in the sport, you know, who involved the sport one way, shape, or form are most likely from marginalized communities.
So for this book, again, it's called Game Misconduct, Hockey's Toxic Culture and How to Fix It. You spoke with players, fans, coaches. So in this book, you have some sort of firsthand accounts of what's happening here. What were some of the things that these individuals were saying?
The thing is, though, like, normally we were thinking, knowing the history of the sport, and some people that wouldn't want to talk, but a lot of people wanted to, you know. And if I could do an overview, like, the length of time we talked to people. Some of them were like 20 minutes and some of them went for hours. And, you know, and all the issues that we, you know, discussed. And we felt like people were looking for something like this, because there's been books about hockey, racism in hockey, like every now and then, but we never really get into the why or the impetus or, you know, the culture that permeates within it and allows a lot of these things to happen. So the fact that people, you know, this were, you know, looking for something like this and the reception has gotten so far, I mean, shows that, hey, like, you know, there's an audience for it.
You know, thinking about this culture, as you say, this toxic culture that's going on right now in hockey, where do you think this comes from? I mean, this has to originate from somewhere. And like I was saying before, I mean, sports, you could say that sports is kind of reflecting certain parts of society. So where do you think this is all stemming from?
I think it stems from three areas, race, culture, and generational. And you look at the fan base of hockey overall, and it's mostly, you know, white male, you know, and over time, you just kind of look at it like, you know, who are hockey fans? Where are they from? What do they look like? What are they into? You know, like, what are all these? Can you do a Venn diagram of what a hockey fan is? And you just kind of notice over time, like, you know, a lot of hockey fans, you know, they gravitate towards the sport because they see more of themselves there.
So, you know, it's interesting. We talk about that and, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could make this more inclusive? So part of the title of the book is How to Fix It. We're talking about a toxic culture situation in this sport of hockey. I know how to fix it's a really big question, but is there some sort of direction that we can go towards in order to rectify this stuff?
I feel like there are some things you can do. You can, like, you know, just automatically, like, you know, stop doing, you know, stop being racist, stop being, you know, handsy with women and kids, stop being bullies, you know, stop acting like, you know, that teamwork and dedication and commitment is only exclusive to your sport. And that's not the case. You see, overall, like, just think about this, like, we turned in our manuscript in January, and how much has happened January this year? So how much has happened to hockey since then? Hockey as a whole operates in a place where if you're in a state or it's where it's, you know, somewhere where it's not something overly popular, things get to fester, things start to happen because it's not where you're looking.
You know, I'm wondering in terms of how to fix this, I'm just thinking about the other major sports and I'm thinking about the activism that has, you know, run through some of these sports. I mean, recently think about the NFL and Colin Kaepernick, which has been going on for a few years. I mean, think about certain players in the NBA. And you think about these athletes who have really brought national attention and worldwide attention to some of these issues when it comes to sexuality, when it comes to gender, when it comes to race. Do we see any of that activism, or is that maybe a little bit more below the surface in the game?
You'd have to look back to the NHL's first diversity effort that took place in 1995, and whatever they're doing obviously didn't work. And then you had, you know, they do this thing called hockey is for everyone. And if you really look at it, I mean, with hockey and using that phrase, it's kind of like it's like saying all lives matter. You know, but these incidents just keep on happening over time. But to answer your question more directly, I remember interviewing former Blackhawk Jamal Mayers for a story a couple of years ago. And I asked him, like, do you think, you know, we'll see some activism in NHL, you know, kind of similar to what we see in the NFL, where, you know, with the players of coalition and, you know, what the guys in the NBA are doing, and especially what the women in WA are doing. And he was like, he didn't really see it happening because hockey's such an insular sport. And these guys are extremely reluctant to separate themselves in one way, shape, or form, whether it's personality, their beliefs, or whatever. But last summer changed everything with the pandemic and a lot of people sitting at home watching George Floyd and watching a man who, you know, who was crying out for a dead mother, you know, as he was dying, and that taking place in a hockey hotbed that was like to call itself the state of hockey. And then you start seeing, you know, white players like speaking out and going to protest and putting out better statements than their teams. And then you have Yeah, a lot of these different people who are doing grassroots activism, like Black Girl Hockey Club, and also HDA, which is the Hockey Diversity Alliance, where it's like made it comprised of several NHLers and other hockey players of color, and they're discussing these issues. It has already gotten to the point where they had to separate themselves from the NHL because. They're the last sport. You think about that at the time, when going back to last summer, when all these different leagues were putting out statements and doing all these things, and hockey was, historically and predictably, we're the only sport, but the NHL was the only sport that kind of drug their feet on a statement, and it took them a while to even, say the words racism. So,
yeah,
we get into that in the book pretty extensively.
Are you optimistic that the culture of the sport can change? Are you optimistic for that going forward?
Yeah, I am to an extent. I mean, Black Girl Hockey Club, they sponsor scholarships for young Black girls to learn how to play the sport. And you have people who are waiting for, who have waited for the NHL for decades to do something tangible, and they haven't. And they're like, well, we're not going to wait for them to do something. And, you have all these different groups and everything else. And, we'll see. I mean, I just kind of think about it where it's like hockey reached me as a kid on the South Side from 71st and Luella, and it also reached my co-author who's a South Asian woman, from New Jersey. It reached us. I feel like that's maybe a silver lining or what have you. But, but also at the same time, there's a lot of people who want to like the sport, but due to how things are, they feel like that they're, passive aggressively told to look elsewhere.
Well, look, this continues. The hope is eternal, which is great, but you are a fan of hockey. This is very much, your favorite sport, and you care deeply about it, but also you want to see it inclusive, which I think is really important as well. The book is called Game Misconduct: Hockey's Toxic Culture and How to Fix It. The co-author of that book is Evan F. Moore. If we want the book, Evan, there's two options. We can hit the big old Amazon or go to your local indie bookstore and pick that sucker up, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like a plan. All right, Evan, thank you so much for talking to us today. I really appreciate it.
Take care. Thanks for having me. Appreciate y'all.
So here we are, Halloween weekend, and I thought it might be fun to take a little dive into the Outside the Loop archives. 4 years ago this weekend, we aired a segment that is kind of spooky, and so we're going to play that segment for us once again in this Outside the Loop Rewind Halloween edition. We are in the shadow of O'Hare International Airport here in the Dunning neighborhood. There's the plane. And right now I'm standing in what's known as Reed Dunning Memorial Park. It's not that big, but it's technically a park. And I'm here with Craig Fonkook, who is a past president of the Chicago Genealogical Society. Craig, here we are in Reed Dunning Memorial Park. And we're standing right now. There's grass all around us, but there's also this concrete sort of, I guess it's like a monument almost.
It is that.
But this area, so again, not a big park. We're surrounded by newer condos and homes. But this area where we are standing right now, many people don't know about. It's tucked away in the Dunning neighborhood. Why is this place significant? Why are we here?
Because for over a century in Chicago and Cook County, this was the home of the poor farm. This was the site of the house for the insane. This is the place where forgotten people of Chicago for over a century were, for want of a better word, dumped. And when they died, they were just simply taken out back and dumped in the open ground, because much of this and century ago was all farm field. And since no one wanted the bodies and the county didn't want to spend any money on burials, they simply plopped them down in what is this great mass grave, this potter's field.
And this is incredible to us in 2017 because we hear that and we think, oh, that's awful. How could you do such a thing, Chicago and Cook County? But really, when you think of a century ago, the people that really were the lowest among us.
Actually, it's almost a century and a half now because we're looking back at the founding of this place in 1859. So that's more than a century and a half. It's something.
And so people that were, like you said, there was an insane asylum around here, an almshouse. So places where the lowest among us would go, yep. And when they would pass away, they obviously didn't have money for a proper burial.
You know, and they weren't even the lowest among us. Think today of people with Alzheimer's. And in those days, people couldn't handle Alzheimer's people. What do you do with them? And so you sent them out here to Dunedin. And the children walked away. What else could they do in those days? There was no such thing as government support systems. And so the grandpa was put here and almost conveniently forgotten and then buried.
I actually heard that it used to be a saying in this area, like, we're going to drag you out to Dunning.
Yes,
you know?
And absolutely.
That's what this means. And so I think it's interesting. So right now we are standing on this, again, monument, this memorial. So this it serves to let us know, and it says right here, erected in 1884.
Yeah, that's the home for the aged that was erected in 1884. We had that earlier poor farm area in 1859 as well. Problem is, in the late 1870s, there was a problem with the government-appointed officials who ran the place and absconded with the funds and went off to Canada.
Shocking in Chicago that would happen. Yes, interesting.
Yeah. And so it's unimaginable to me that we're looking out over this area where people were buried. And, you know, they weren't even buried in rows. They were buried willy-nilly. They were just one night somebody got buried, and a few days later somebody else got buried. And as that went on for over 100 years, they didn't remember. They didn't map where people got buried. And so then they dug a hole, and we just cut through an old body. And in fact, my daughter was on the archaeological crew that worked this site. And she told me when they had to come in and hand dig the footings for a lot of these buildings that surround us, they were finding body parts. Not just body parts, but they were finding glasses. They were finding jewelry. They were finding belt buckles. When they died, they were just taken out and unceremoniously dropped in a hole. And they couldn't excavate this whole site. I mean, this site was never excavated as a site. It was trenched. These buildings were trenched by hand.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, I mean, this can't be the only place in Chicago where this has gone on, right?
No. Number one, right near the archdiocesan home of the Catholic Church, there's an old Chicago cemetery under Dearborn Street. And then, of course, you have the Chicago City Cemetery, which is plopped right on top by the Chicago History Museum, and the couch tomb is the only thing left. And when they built the parking lot further north of LaSalle Street, they came up with all kinds of bodies. And so that whole area there, that too is a mass grave with no markers, no memorials. And we see what was put up as a memorial. But there were next to no stones here either, because nobody's going to spend money to memorialize these people. And so all you had was this field. And thankfully, it was remembered by a number of people who decided that, wow, it can't just be all built over with buildings. We have to do something to remember.
I think it's remarkable. And, you know, the Chicago Genealogical Society, I know, has done a lot of work with this. And, again, you think about just the history of Chicago. I think today we're so caught up in houses and condos and things like that, we forget what came before us.
You know, in terms of the Chicago Genealogical Society doing the work, you got to give credit to a guy named Barry Fleeg, who I think he's still alive in Arizona. And Barry did a magnificent job of going through the newspapers looking for mention of some somebody having died in Dunning. And that's how we have a list of some of the over 35,000 people who are buried here. And he's only got about 8,000 or 9,000 people on his database. And there were no records. You know, all of a sudden a genealogist does some work and says, oh, where are all the people? And where's my great-grandfather? And, oh, he disappeared. Well, then we say, well, he went to Dunning. But the Dunning records were destroyed as well. So we can't know who most of the people who are under these buildings and in this park. We can't know who they were. And that's pretty darn sad.
Yeah, it really
everybody,
is.
Everybody deserves a bit of memory.
I would agree with that. And hopefully we are giving some memory to the folks by doing something
Absolutely.
Like this and this
Absolutely.
Memorial. And thank you for all your work. I know that you have got a lot going on still, even with the Chicago Genealogical Society and all of your work. Again, Craig Fahncook is the past president of the Chicago Genealogical Society here in Reed Dunning Memorial Park. Craig, thanks for talking to us today about this tucked away piece of history in Chicago.
You're quite welcome. I hope more people come out and visit this site.
Pretty creepy. Happy Halloween. I think that's kind of a cool piece of Chicago history as well. And we can all check out the Reed Dunning Memorial Park on the northwest side of Chicago. And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 785 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show this week. Thanks to Bob Ferguson for being our engineer, as always. Have a fantastic week and happy Halloween. Enjoy the trick-or-treating. This is Outside the Loop here on 720 WGN.